Well, this is Robin Shanti, and I'm speaking with Steve Earle, who is most well known to those of you listening as a musician and songwriter. In addition to music, though, Steve is also a political activist, an actor with a recurring role on the HBO show Tremé, a playwright, with a play that he produced off-Broadway about the death penalty called Carla, which is about the first woman to be executed by the state of Texas since the death penalty was reinstated there. He's been the host of radio shows on Air America and Sirius Satellite Radio, and he's currently on tour promoting his new novel, I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. Steve, welcome to KBOO.
It's good to be here.
Well, given that intro...
It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, you're an incredibly prolific guy. How do you find the time to actually sit down and write a novel?
Well, it took a long time, and it was in between. You know, my day job is I make records and write songs, and I have bills to pay like everybody else. So that's why it took 8 years to write this book that doesn't seem big enough to have taken 8 years to write.
Wow.
I mean, it really, most of it was written in the last five, but I began it 8 years ago. The idea sort of was born 8 years ago when I published a collection of short fiction about 9 years ago. And after that, I kind of started, you know, at least outlining, you know, the ideas for this story. And it's just it was tough. And every time you stop, to make a record or go on the road or whatever, it takes days and sometimes weeks to get back in the saddle again. It's a
sure.
whole different thing about writing the long form rather than writing. I'm used to telling stories that are pretty developed in 4 or 5 minutes. So this is different though. It's like, it's a lot of characters, a lot more characters than I thought it would be. I thought when I first started, I thought it was going to have two characters that, you know, that really mattered, which were Doc Ebersol and Hank Williams' ghost, and it sort of got out of hand on me at some point, and it's sort of heavily populated now, so which was cool. I didn't know how it was going to end until a relatively short time before I finished it. It was probably within a couple of months before I finished it, before I actually knew exactly what was going to happen at the end.
Well, the title is based on the last single that Hank Williams released before
right.
he died. What does Hank Williams mean to you, since he plays such a pivotal role in the book? And
well,
just
I mean,
as
I'm a singer-songwriter who lived in Nashville for 33 years. I think if you're a singer-songwriter, especially, like if you're both of those things in Nashville, then you're haunted by Hank Williams anyway. So it's Nashville's not particularly singer-songwriter friendly. It's always like singers in one corner and songwriters in the other corner. It's just, there's something about, and I don't think there's anything evil about it. I think it's about business, and it's about economics, and it's about a sense of control from the people that, you know, that founded the music industry. I think they always were more comfortable with a singer and a songwriter who was maybe equally talented, you know, was something that all of a sudden had, you know, more power than they could deal with. And Hank had plenty of his own problems, and I don't think that anything that Hank did to himself had anything to do with that dynamic. But I think Hank was such a big deal, and he disappointed people because of his own, you know, his own self-destructiveness. And I think that, you know, there's this attitude that was sort of born in the post-Hank Williams era where, you know, they decided there nothing like that was ever going to happen again, and the city became very singer-songwriter unfriendly. At least I found it to be trying to be a singer-songwriter there.
That's an interesting perspective. Yeah. I've never really heard that before. I sort of think of it as, I mean, Austin to me is, you know, certainly a mecca for singer-songwriters. And
yeah, that's the deal. I mean, I think Nashville is a more legitimate, you know, destination for the mainstream music business, but country music in and of itself, that country music industry, there haven't been that many singer-songwriters. You see a lot of artists now that have their names on songs, but then they're co-writing with other writers, and that's just become, you know, I think it's arguable how much they actually have to do with writing the song, some of them. But it's when I was living there, you know, I got there in 1974, and I lived there until 2005. And during that time, the singers and the songwriters were pretty much, the singers were in one corner and the songwriters were in the other. And I was sort of an anomaly, and they didn't dig it all that much. Some people, you know, I had a number one country record, a number one country album. And, But almost immediately, you know, I started having trouble, you know, getting along with that establishment and getting on country radio after the first record. It was sort of like, oops, we let that slip through there. We don't want that to happen again. And it was okay. I was okay with living there and doing what I did, and I found an audience anyway. But it's an interesting place.
That's funny because I erroneously assumed that you spent all that time in Austin, not Nashville.
No, no, Austin's the one place I did. I never lived there. I'm from San Antonio, and Austin was, you know, I started going to Austin. I spent a lot of time there. I started going there. The first time I went there was probably in the 70s and the early 70s. I ran away from home and went to Austin once. But it was, you know, when I got out on my own and started hitchhiking around with a guitar, the girls were too pretty and the weather was too good and the dope was too cheap. And I knew I'd never get anything done in a place like that. So I went to Houston and then on to Nashville.
Well, I lived in Texas for 8 years during the Reagan-Bush years.
Right.
And grew up there for part of my life. And Austin is kind of, Austin or San Antonio, I always say, are the two places that, to live. If you're
Well,
live
it
there.
Was, you know, it's interesting. I kind of, I lived there in an era when there you couldn't imagine a Republican governor in Texas. There hadn't been one. Ever.
That's true.
And so when I was growing up, so, you know, to me, Houston was I think by far the hippest town in a lot of ways. I mean, ZZ Top's from Houston. Lightning Hopkins was from Houston. You know, Towns Van Zandt, you know, really, you know, based out of Houston rather than Austin. I mean, I think people sort of erroneously associate Towns with Austin, but he really was more of a Houston thing. So it was Guy Clark. Guy Clark's from Houston. So It's one of those things, I think, of Mickey Newberry, Houston, you know. So it's one of those deals. And, you know, and then there's San Antonio, me, Doug Somm, Charlie Sexton. We're all from San Antonio. Although Charlie lives in Austin, has for a long time. He's still there. So,
well, in your book, you write about, well, I'll call the seedy side of San Antonio.
Right.
And a lot of your characters, you know, are a little hard in the beginning to sympathize with.
Right.
How did the seed of those characters really come to you? Did
well,
you know that part,
you know,
of town?
People, they're based on people I knew. Not necessarily in San Antonio. Some in San Antonio, but I'm a recovering heroin addict, and so I used to hang out with people like the people in this book. If you know, it's like the first time I went to Australia, I was toward the end of my first career, you know, which everything sort of, you know, got away from me because of my drug habit. And I had to start all over again in the mid '90s, but. The first time I went to Australia, I was pretty much in the grips of, you know, of my disease. And, you know, so I didn't even see a kangaroo. I saw addicts and prostitutes. I saw the same people that I saw in the States. You know, if you're a heroin addict, that's who you hang out with. That's where the dope is. And so that's that part of it's, I think they say write what you know.
So. I want to ask you about your play that you wrote called Carla.
Right.
About the first woman to be executed when the death penalty was reinstated. As a political activist, do you work on that issue?
That's my main area of activism. It has been for a long time. And you know, I've written three songs that deal with that issue. First one was a song called Billy Austin I wrote in the late 80s. And then there's LSU Unit 1 for Dead Man Walking. And that was just Tim Robbins called me and asked me. He knew that I was, you know, and he'd heard Billy Austin, so he called and asked me if I would write something for Dead Men. And then another song called Over Yonder that I wrote several years later, which is about a guy named Jonathan Nobles, who was an inmate in Texas who I knew really well. In fact, I ended up witnessing his execution before it was over with. And I, you know, I think you got to pick something. I think the movement against the death penalty is my main area of activism. It's not the only thing I do, but it's the main thing I do. I think a country that didn't have the death penalty would have never attacked Iraq because somebody had to pay for what happened on September 11th, even if it wasn't, you know, the right country or the right person. And, you know, I think the whole, I'm glad I wasn't in New York City when Osama bin Laden was killed, because I happened to be in Chicago and, you know, doing what I'm doing right now. And I don't think... it would have been hard for me to watch kids jumping up and down, you know, chanting USA, USA, most of whom were 10 years old when on September 11th, you know. I just don't, it's not a hockey game. And I think, you know, the whole concept of retribution is faulty, and it's you know, so I think that you know, it's not about trying to save anybody on death row. I think it's bad for us, and to practice retribution as a matter of course. You know, the idea that somebody has to pay in blood for blood is a really, really toxic idea, and I think it makes I think we're supposed to be evolving past that. I think it's what I've always believed.
You know, it was curious to me that the book is set in 1963 when John F. Kennedy, right before the day before he died.
Right.
And, you know, there's this theme of Hank Williams' ghost going through the book. And I've always felt that, you know, Texans are haunted by the assassination in many ways.
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt about it. No doubt about it. And, it was arbitrary at first. It was like 10 years after I counted on my fingers, 10 years after Hank died to set the story. I set it in San Antonio because they say write what you know. So, right. And it was close enough geographically. It was feasible to me that Doc could have ended up there. And was okay. What happened in 1963? Well, one of the things that happened to me in 1963 is I lived in San Antonio. My dad was an air traffic controller, and my mother was getting us ready for school. My dad was on the midnight shift one morning, and called my mother and said, keep the boys out of school because Kennedy's landing at the airport at 10:30, and bring them down because they may never get to see this again. And so we skipped out of school and rode in a Ford station wagon to the airport. And, you know, you could go right up to the fence on the edge of the tarmac in those days. There was no security to speak of in airports. We saw Kennedy and Jackie land, and then on the last full day that he was on this planet.
Wow.
And very vivid memory. I was 8 years old, but it was a very vivid memory for me. And so when the book was in 1963 anyway, I decided to bring that into the story.
You know, you have a new CD out also with the same title as the book. Is that a coincidence, or how did those
not
influence
a coincidence.
Each other?
It wasn't contrived that way. It was like I avoided it. I thought about it several times, but basically what happened was the book was obviously always going to be called this for obvious reasons. This the Hank Williams angle is where it comes from, and the record I made this record with T-Bone Burnett, and I wrote the songs over 3 years. And they were the same 3 years that a lot of the book was written, the last, you know, March on the book, which was over half of the book. And my dad died 3 years ago. And, you know, when I got the record finished and sequenced it and listened to it, T-Bone and I were listening to it for the first time, and I realized it was about some of the same things that the book's about, which is spirituality, and spirituality as it relates to mortality and the differences in that in different cultures. And I think I saw that when my dad left here kind of scared and everybody around him was scared, and he was maybe fighting a little harder than was probably best for him, and nobody was really giving him permission to go. And mm-hmm. I think that's what we do in this society. I think the way almost every move we make as a people is based on fear of death, and this is like, you know, there's a lot in this book and a lot in the songs on the record that are about the idea that death is part of life rather than, you know, this. I mean, it's definitely unknown. It's definitely scary because we're scared of anything we don't know that we can't guarantee is going to be okay. And but I've seen people. I saw a friend of mine in Woodstock that got ill, and then he was in remission, and then he wasn't, and then he went pretty fast. But he had friends around him that were people more like me. You know, it's Woodstock. It was kind of an alternative community in the first place. And everybody there, you know, didn't necessarily think of things in a strictly Western, you know, Judeo-Christian, Islamic, you know, God of Abraham kind of spiritual slant.
Wrathful
and because
God.
Of that, they just, he seemed more ready to go, and everybody else seemed a lot more okay with letting him go and giving him permission to. And it seemed like a kinder, gentler, you know, way to go into that good night, you know, from observing it from sort of a distance.
Well, since you have been in recovery, do you have a particular spiritual outlook that guides you?
The 12-step programs are my spiritual system. It's the only one I have. And I know people that I run into in 12-step programs that have other spiritual systems. I just don't happen to have one. For me, it's still pretty simple. It's like there's even a song that says it on the record. It's like, you know, I believe there is a God and it ain't me. And that's as far as I've been able to get. And I'm okay with that. I mean, maybe maybe there is something out after this and I'll figure it out later. Maybe not. But you know what? There's either a God or there's not. And I'm nowhere near arrogant enough to think that God's existence depends on whether I believe in God or not. So I it's sort of, you know, my belief is that there is. You know, I'm totally okay with anybody else believing that there's not. I don't think they're going to pay a penalty for it. Mm. I think we're all going to end up, you know, I think we're all going to get the same stuff. I think there's plenty of consequences to deal with right here, right now. You know, my experience is I had some pretty horrific things happen to me because I abused myself. I abused people around me. And, you know, and I stopped doing all that stuff. And you know what? Mostly good stuff happens to me now. And I'm a big believer of that. I don't drive around looking over my shoulder anymore. I don't, you know, my life's a lot different. So I believe in all that stuff. I believe I'm obviously an optimist. I started over having kids again in my mid-50s. That's pretty optimistic. You have to give me that.
You have a young son, huh?
He's a year old on April 5th, yeah.
Wow.
My oldest is 29. My youngest is 1. So.
Wow, and a new marriage, I would assume, to go with that.
Yeah, I'm married to somebody else that does what I do. And you know, I got married a lot in the 80s, but I hadn't been married in a long time. This is the first time I've ever been married sober, and it's a completely different thing. I have a really, really good life at this point.
And your wife is a singer.
Yeah, right? She's a great singer. Her name's Allison Moore, and she's a singer and a songwriter. And she's playing piano and organ in the band now. And so all of us, me, Allison, John Henry, the dogs, everybody will get on a bus. And the tour is going to start in Seattle on the 9th of June, and we'll be here on the 10th. And
Crystal Ballroom.
And we'll be out all, you know, all summer until fall, and then we'll go to Europe. And my life is good. I get to do something I really, really love doing, and I don't have to be away from my family to do it anymore. I'm kind of terrified right now because I'm on this promotional thing by myself, and John Henry is about to walk any second. I get home day after tomorrow. I'm terrified he's going to do it before I get there. So
no, he'll hold
just two more towns. I told her to, you know, tie something to him or something so he has trouble getting up for a couple of days just to make sure I get there. So
well, at least we have the technology now that you can maybe see.
No, I see him almost every day. You know, I can see him on my phone. I can see him on an iPad. And that's true. That's a totally different thing. It's really cool. I've been using that technology lately.
Have you ever toured with someone that you've been in an intimate relationship with before?
Well, I have for the entire time Allison and I've been together, six mm-hmm. years. You know, we that's how we met, basically. She was the opening act on the Revolution Starts Now tour. And that's how we got together. We toured together the tour after that when Washington Square Serenade was out. And a lot of touring in between those record cycles. And then the Towns tour, Allison was pregnant, so she sat all but the first leg of that tour out and stayed home. And a bus rattling around a couple of continents is not the best place for a pregnant person to be. And this tour, we're all back together and baby and dogs and all, and we'll be out on the bus.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Steve Earle, and he has just come out with a new novel, I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. And it's really a wonderful book. And I have to ask you, the particular style that you chose to write the book. You know, I read places people call it magical realism. It's, right. You know, it's hard to pigeonhole into that.
It's kind of a Harry Potter book for adults is what it turned into. And I'm not sure what I intended it to be was, you know. I patterned it originally after a book called Coming Through Slaughter, which was Michael Ondaatje's first novel.
Oh, he's such a great writer.
Oh, he's a great writer. And we've got to be friends since my first book came out. We read together in Chicago several years ago. And I actually am very proud of the fact that I'm in a Michael Ondaatje book. And Anil's ghost, there's a character listening to Fearless Heart on her.
All right.
Yeah, on her earbuds in one scene in the book. So, Coming Through Slaughter is about Buddy Bolden, who was a legendary cornet player in New Orleans, the turn of the last century. who never made records because he became insane before recording came along. And so we don't know what he sounded like, but Louis Armstrong knew what he sounded like. So he was hugely influential. And he disappeared, supposedly, according to legend, for 30 days in 1909. And when he came back, he was never the same again. And Coming to Slaughter is sort of Michael's speculation on what happens in those 30 days. And so that was sort of where I got the idea of, like, you know, these stories, basing a piece of fiction on these stories. I'd always heard that there was a doctor traveling with Hank Williams when he died. And, you know, I'd always heard that. When I did the research, it turns out the guy that was traveling with Hank wasn't really a doctor. He claimed to be a doctor. He called himself doctor, but he wasn't. He had no degree. In fact, he had no college diploma of any sort. And his name was Toby Marshall. And he claimed,
Dr. Feelgood?
He claimed he could cure alcoholism by administering chloral hydrate, which is a barbiturate. And it probably worked for some people because you cannot drink if you are dead. And it was one of the drugs that was found in Hank's system when he died. Hank used morphine too, but I never found any evidence that he used it for any other reason except for pain. Hank had spina bifida. So he was in excruciating physical pain every single minute of the 29 years that he was on this planet.
Wow.
So it was, and that was a big part of who he was too, was he was in physical pain as well as any emotional language he was in.
It's going to give me a whole new listening vibe when I listen to Hank Williams. I wanted to ask you, you were part of the HBO series Tremé.
Right.
Which is by David Simon. Is it David Simon?
Yeah, David Simon.
I don't know, I was spaced out on his name for a second. Who also did The Wire, many of you might be familiar with out there. Were you in New Orleans when the Gulf oil spill happened?
I was, which is where the song The Gulf of Mexico and I'll Never Get Out of This World of Life came from. We all were. We were kind of finishing the first season of Tremé. And, you know, we were patting ourselves on the back because felt like we were doing something positive for the community, and we were. There were a lot of people working in Tremé, and they've just renewed it for a third year, so there are people celebrating that right now, I promise you, because it's jobs. And you know, there were oysters bigger than your fist, and, you know, things were looking up. You know, New Orleans was kind of coming back. It didn't become Disneyland because the economy, that's one of the positive things about the economy in the country collapsing, was there were people that had big plans for New Orleans, and they had to put those plans on hold. And so New Orleans is still New Orleans. It's 100,000 less people there than there were before.
Wow.
But everybody that's there is plenty enough weird to make up for it, and it's just a world unto itself. There's no place like New Orleans. It's a little dangerous, but it's worth it. You know, just my suggestion is go and watch your backbone, as my friends in Jamaica used to say. And it's a musical heart of America. And Tremé, Beaubourg Tremé, the neighborhood that this TV show is named after, which is the neighborhood directly behind the quarter in New Orleans, is the musical heart of New Orleans. And that's why he called the show that.
What's it been like? I know I've seen your music in films and even on The Wire. Was the song the
I did the
song?
Last. There's a Tom Waits song that was the theme song for all five seasons. And you know, when I was hired to play Waylon for the last season, you know, because you know, whenever Bubbles got clean, then they brought Waylon back. And when David emailed me and let me know. And he let me know in the same email it was going to be the last season. And I emailed him straight back and said, well, then I want to do Way Down in the Hole this time, because I knew it was my last chance. It had been a different artist every year. The first year it's a Tom Waits song, but the first year they used a version by the Blind Boys of Alabama. Second year they used the Waits version, the original version. The third year was the Neville Brothers. The fourth year was a local hip-hop crew from Baltimore. Yeah, called Doja May, and then I did it the last year, and as John King produced it, and it's on Washington Square Serenade, the record that I was making at that time. So it's a pretty intimidating thing for a songwriter of my generation to cover a Tom Waits song, but it was pretty cool. I'm pretty proud of it.
Well, now that you're how many more cities do you have on this book tour?
Just Seattle tomorrow, and then I go home. I've been out a couple of weeks, and I'm like a I'm sort of retracing my steps backwards. I was just through all this, and I was here just a couple of weeks ago when the record came out. The week the record came out, I was at Music Millennium, and I just go tomorrow, and then we'll spend the weekend. We're gonna go up to it's Wavy Gravy's 75th birthday, and since it's his 75th birthday, he's gone by Coastal this year for his birthday party. So there's a Berkeley celebration last week, like there always was, and the New York version is this weekend in New York City. So Allison and I are going to play that, and then we'll go up to Woodstock, where we have a home on Saturday, and sort of start getting ready for the tour. We'll go to Nashville, like on the 31st, and rehearse for about a week, and then the first show is on June 9th in Seattle at the Moore Theater, and then we will be here at the Crystal Ballroom on the 10th.
Well, we really look forward to seeing you. And are there any other books, do you think, percolating in there?
Maybe, but I've got another play that I've started, which will be the next it's not exactly a non-musical project, but it's the next project is a play, which I'm not quite ready to talk about yet.
Well, Steve Earle, thank you so much for being here. Again, the name of the book is I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. And thanks so much for dropping by.
Thank you.